Richard and I have known each other for more years than we'll be, we'll talk about. He was one of the founders of a firm that, you know, when I thought about some of the major, the top five firms that dealt with emerging technology businesses, that was one of them. He left, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago?
About seven, actually.
And now Richard is with Carter English, which is, and you can talk about Carter English. Richard is unique in a couple of ways. One, like you, he is both a scientist and an attorney. He has a degree in physics from MIT and a JD from Cornell University. And he does a lot of work in the technology space, but he kind of understands it because he's a scientist. He does a lot of transactional work, and so that's one of his roles. But the other role that he has is that he's a founder of an angel investment company. So he not only assists companies, but he also is an investor as well, and he works with other investors. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
So, hey, floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Larry. So to fill in a little bit, McCarter in English is a relatively new name in town, but it's a fairly big firm. They acquired Gadsby and Hanna, which is a name that you're probably familiar with. It was one of the older, more established law firms in Boston. McCarter acquired it a couple of years ago as its Boston office. And I was recruited in by a friend of mine who heads up the corporate practice there, and among other things, most of my time there is spent as part of a sort of a boutique law practice for emerging tech companies that's within this big firm into which we can reach out when we need specialized help, of which we've got just about everything imaginable. In fact, McCarter recently made it onto the list of the largest 10 IP firms in Boston as a result of an acquisition they did a couple of years ago of a big IP group. Larry mentioned the angel group that I formed, it's Launchpad, which is now up to 100 members and I think is by far the largest angel group in Boston. Whether it's a good idea to have large angel groups is something I'll talk about a little bit in this session. And if I forget to mention that, make sure to remind me. I should also mention I'm working on forming a new angel group right now with a friend of mine called Sidecar Angels. And Sidecar has got as far as we can tell, a unique spin. I don't think anybody else in the country is doing this. It's providing its members with the opportunity to co-invest with other angel groups and micro VCs, and it's only going to be a co-investor. And there are a bunch of reasons for that, which I won't go into now, but one of the sources of the inspiration for this is that, as I'll get into a little more later, virtually all the angel group deals in the Boston area now are syndicated. Syndication and angel groups being a fancy term for one group finds the company, doesn't have enough money to provide all the money the company needs and brings in other groups. And even when they do have enough money, they bring in other groups because there's a lot of second round investing now by angel groups. And then orthogonal to all of that, but I'll mention it because a lot of you are on not-for-profit boards, for the sins of a past life, I've actually learned a lot about nonprofit compensation and executive compensation over the years, and I can talk my way around intermediate sanctions and things like that pretty well. And I should also mention, if you're on the board of a nonprofit and nobody's talked to you about intermediate sanctions, grab me after the meeting and I'll keep you out of trouble. So the topic tonight is trends in angel investing and venture capital investing. And before I start, did anybody come here with particular questions, particular things they want to hear about in that topic? And I'll try to address those. Okay, well, something, Larry has told me this is informal, notwithstanding the tie, and interactive, so I'm happy to take interruptions and questions at any point along the line.
I think one thing that's interesting is how things have been changing as far as term sheets go.
Mm-hmm. Good. I thank you, because I'm definitely going to be talking about that. Okay, so the first interesting thing about this is that I did the August 2nd, I put this to bed. I had done all the research, I had prepared the presentation, I had it printed, and I was set to go. And then about a week later, I thought, Jiminy Christmas, okay, so that's all changed. And what you see in front of you is about the fifth version. no joke of this. So second interesting thing is I realized that when you talk about trends, it's easy to talk about what's gone on in the past. I mean, you just collect the numbers and you crunch the numbers and you can see, you know, things have gone up, things have gone down, things have bounced around. I mean, you know exactly what's happened. Projecting it out is completely different. On August 2nd, again, when I put this to bed, it looked like I could talk about, well, here are how things are going and probably leave it at that. Now I'm sort of reminded of, if you Google William Goldman, he was I think he may still be active. I'm not sure if he's alive, but he was one of the top Hollywood screenwriters for many years. And in show business circles, which I know a bit about, not personally, but through friends in the business, he said something years ago in an interview, which is very famous in show business circles. He was asked for his comment about how movie studios figured out what was going to be a hit and where they invested these huge amounts of money that movie studios invest. And he said to the reporter, look, the first thing you have to understand about Hollywood is that nobody knows anything. And there's a little bit of that going on right now in terms of predicting these trends. Nevertheless, I do have some hard data. This is where I spend my days, so I do have some anecdotal experience, boots on the ground and so forth. So I can give you some thoughts, and I'd love to, you know, hear other people's opinions and information on this. So the first thing I will talk about is investment trends. And in terms of the trends, first thing we look at are VC deals and how those have been going. And the VC deals, the trends, even before August, the trends were somewhat mixed. If you looked at Q2 for this year, which is the latest figure for which I could get some, latest period for which I could get some numbers on, there was over $1 billion of VC deals done in New England, which is a 10-year high. And for those of us who work with emerging tech companies, this is just great news. Anecdotally, because all the numbers aren't in yet, the number of Series A and Series B deals in New England were down in Q1 of 2011 versus Q4 of, that should be 2010, not 2012, if that's what it says in your thing.
But they
were up again in Q2, and the deal sizes in Q1 of this year, we had across the country at $6.4 billion in 661 venture deals, and that was virtually the same as the run rate for per quarter for 2010 on the average. The total number of deals in the last quarter of 2010 were somewhat higher, $7.6 billion. Hard to know what that means, frankly. It's all I can say is that it's been bouncing around. The other good news, again, at the time for which we have final numbers, is the exits for the venture-backed companies were up. There were 420 in 2010 versus only 273 in 2009. I mean, given what was going on in 2009 versus 2010, that's not surprising. But the other good news about those 2010 exit numbers is that was the highest number of venture-backed company exits since tracking was started in 1985. And exits where the return on the venture investment was 4x or more. Yeah?
What was the criteria to call something a deal?
For the deal, so it's Series A, Series B. It was an equity round.
Okay, just publicly, I'm sorry. It was registered, you know?
Well, it wasn't necessarily, yeah, registered, but there are people out there who look at the filings in the state corporate offices and track the deals that way, because when a venture fund makes an investment, in most cases, it's a preferred stock investment. Because it's a preferred stock investment, the corporate charter is going to be adjusted. That requires a filing in the state corporate office. Those are public documents, so that people just watch that stuff and they can see, okay, so this company amended its charter, and it added Series A or Series B or Series C preferred stock, which it never had before. Must have been a deal, and we could figure out how much money went in. So the other good thing about the trend in venture-backed company exits was that 45% in 2010 represented a return of 4x or better. Why that's particularly important to the VC industry will become clearer when I talk later about trends in the VC industry. And the IPO window is starting to open up again. Nationally, for Q2 of this year, we had 140 companies that were in registration. That means not that they've gone public yet, but they're in the registration process. And that's a 24% increase versus over the number that were in registration in the second quarter of 2010. And the highest since late 2007. So it looked, until the recent unpleasantness, as they say down south, that IPO window was back. 82 companies actually filed their IPOs, and 42 came to market. And there were 72 of those 82 were venture-backed IPOs in 2010 versus only 12 in 2009. Again, that was the highest since 2007. Yeah. This is pretty critical, because if you're a VC, I mean, if you're not getting out through the IPO window, it's really hard to make the numbers that attract your limited partners for the next round.
Excuse me, does this reflect going public in different markets or just domestic markets?
Just domestic markets.
Are you
going to...
Are you going to talk about the new fund raising for venture groups?
I am. Good. Seems like I actually anticipated people's questions. Excuse me. So then I looked at the IPO activity around Boston, because we're always in competition with Silicon Valley, New York, and so forth. So how are we doing? And the numbers I've got here are companies in registration as of late July 2011. Now, again, the monkey wrench in this whole thing is that if you were sitting here in July and said, okay, these companies are actually in registration, you had a high degree of confidence that they were actually going to make it through the knothole and go public. A couple weeks later, wasn't so sure anymore. So this is a list of companies in the Boston area that were in the IPO registration process. In other words, they're on deeply in the process for going public. The one on the first page here that I know made it out was Carbonite, and they made it out in the teeth of 400-point swings in the market. No doubt didn't raise as much money as they would have if they'd gone out in July. But they did make it out. That's a company I've got a lot of affection for, because, like probably most of you in the room, I have Carbonite on my computers. And the service is just, I'm not a stockholder, so this isn't a plug, but I mean, the service just gets better. I actually checked my configuration a couple weeks ago and realized that the last time I looked, which is probably years ago, there was like a 50-gigabyte cap, and now there's no cap. Video, whatever you want, just throw it in there and they'll take it. Which ties into another trend, which I'll also talk about in terms of capital efficiency and how much less it costs to start a tech company these days. So that's the VC trends. Now, the angel trends are harder to get at because a lot of angel deals don't really produce a public record. And there are surveys done by the Angel Capital Association, which is sort of the umbrella club National Club of Angel Groups. They are working with a consulting firm, I believe, on a new system which is called HALO. I don't it's an acronym. I don't recall what it stands for. But once that's in place, there'll be much better data around angel deals. So for the angel data, I had to go all the way back to 2008 because the Angel Capital Association does an annual survey, and it takes them a long time to get the data out. What was interesting about 2008 is that, first of all, angel investment did not stop, which is by itself is an interesting statistic because I went to a great presentation at TIE, the Indus Entrepreneurs Group, about a year ago. On company valuations. And the fellow who was doing the presentation had just great data on valuations of seed stage deals, Series A, Series B, and Series C. And there was a lot of interesting stuff there that would be a presentation in itself about how those trends go. One of the interesting ones about seed stage deals is that, well, by the time you get up to Series C, if you look at Series C valuations in NASDAQ, it tracks pretty closely. By the time you get down to seed stage deals, the exit IPO or sale is so far away that what NASDAQ is doing on at that point in time isn't all that relevant and doesn't drive it. So his line for the seed stage deals, this is what's interesting about 2008, this goes between $1 and $3 million. I mean, which kind of confirms my own personal experience that unless you're Dean Kamen or it's a biotech company or something like that, the valuation of the seed stage deals are always between $1 and $3 million. But then there's this one period where the line just disappeared for a couple of months in 2008. There just weren't any deals. Nevertheless, the angels kept the faith. I mean, they kept having meetings. They kept looking at companies. I mean, a lot of angel money is kind of like, you know, the last money that you invest. You know, you've done your asset allocation, then you've got money you feel you can afford to lose entirely. I mean, the risk, the beta is like infinite. So if you've got like 10% of your assets kind of mentally allocated towards that, and your portfolio has dropped by 30%, you're probably not in the mood to do a lot of angel investing. But again, people kept going. And the average group investment, this is not individual angels, but the average angel group investment per deal in 2008 was about $280,000, which was about the same as 2007, which I found an interesting statistic. And I think it's driven by the fact that if you get much smaller than that, you're into the friends and family and rich uncle category. So for an angel group, it's going to do a deal, you know, much below $280,000 average. It's probably just not, they're not going to do it because it meant the company's not interesting enough for them to bother with anyway. And they'll say, you know, go get some traction, go talk to your rich uncle and come back when you have more to show us. The average number of investments in 2008 was down but compared to 2007, but only by 16%, which again, I found a surprising number. But for a guy who makes his living as an attorney for emerging tech companies, one that was pretty encouraging. Some other angel trends, a couple of things that, I mean, I do know, is, as I mentioned earlier, almost all the deals are syndicated, which means the angel groups band together. And right now, and I'll talk about this more later in terms of predicting the future, this is, you know, the time of the angels. It's so much cheaper to start a tech company, for reasons I'll talk about later, that angels can get a lot more bang for the buck. There are a lot more companies that can be launched for angel investments. If the gyrations of the stock market and the national budget don't screw things up, there are more exits available. And hence, there's a lot of talk about, you know, are we in another technology investment bubble, except this time, rather than being at the IPO stage of things, are we at a bubble at the angel level? Somebody was quoted recently as saying, it can't be a bubble if everybody's talking about it as being a bubble. So I think the kind of the word on the street there is, if people either stop talking about being a bubble or your cab driver starts talking to you about the great tech startup he invested in, that's the time to get out. But right now, it just looks like, you know, it's a little frothy, but after what went on with LinkedIn, for example, which had this huge pop and then settled back down, I think people are getting a little bit more careful. And of course, you know, Carbonite made it out. I'm not sure where they are today compared to the price they went out at, but I don't think they have a huge pop. I also don't think they had a big decline either in the last few weeks. Okay, so structural trends in the venture capital and angel world. Well, venture capital, back in 98, 99, we started the Launchpad Group, which is an angel group, not a venture capital group. I knew of a fair number of people who were partners in venture capital funds, and I couldn't figure out why the hell they were. Okay, I mean, they weren't stupid, okay? They just weren't that much smarter than I was. And I started out in the dealing with tech companies. I hate to tell you how far back, but, you know, let's say, you know, long ago. And venture capital is really hard. If you didn't have, you know, like a lot of experience, you just couldn't do it. First of all, people wouldn't give you the money, and secondly, you'd fail fast. And as we got into the tech bubble of the late 90s, there was a period there where it looked like not anybody, but like a lot of people could do it, and a lot of people were doing it. And it was very interesting, and I have to confess I had a little bit of envy, of running across people who basically, because they knew other people in the other general partners, and they were liked, and they seemed to have something to bring to the table, they were brought in as partners into these venture capital funds, and for a while, at least, were making a lot of money. Then, you know, the tech bubble in NASDAQ collapsed, and it was the classic Warren Buffett line, you know, you find out who's swimming naked when the tide goes out. And it became apparent that this is, you know, a lot harder than it looks. In my own personal experience, I mean, I've got some people I've known from way back who were personal friends before they became VCs and who are still successful at it. And they're some of the, you know, smartest and most experienced people I know, all of which bears on, you know, some numbers here. The 10-year returns from venture capital, the entire industry, not selected funds, as of Q2 of last year, was negative. It was more money going in than coming back to the limiteds. Q3, even worse. If you look at this in terms of what referred to as vintage years, in other words, the fund, you know, what year the fund was formed, that's the year of its vintage, the median net return for vintage years has not been positive for vintage years since 1998. That doesn't mean there aren't people making a hell of a lot of money in venture capital. You know, we all know about Facebook, Google, and lots of others that you may not have heard of. But overall, it's not been, on average, a great deal for the limiteds. And even for the top quartile funds, the best vintage was 2001, where the return for the top quartile was about 5.6%. So as you can imagine, if you actually graph this out, I'm sorry, I couldn't find a good graph of this. The returns from the bottom quartile to the top quartile seem to go like this, and then when you get into the top quartile, you get, you know, near the top of the top quartile, and it just, you know, pops, you know, way up. And those are the people that make venture capital a investment that people continue to look at. On the next page, there's an interesting graph of the performance of private equity, which you can ignore because I'm not talking about now, U.S. venture capital versus various indices. And if you look at it, you can see that for the most recent quarter, which was the for which we have numbers, which was September 30th of 2010, stock indices, the Dow Jones, the S&P, and so forth, were running around 11-12% for that quarter. Venture capital was 3.7%. Then you go off to the right, and you're going back, you're picking up extended periods of time. You'll see the performance, you know, starts to decline, and then it comes back up. So if you go, if you look at a 15-year return, the Dow Jones return is 7.9%, which, you know, if you could do that consistently, that's not too shabby. But venture capital was almost 37%. So, you know, if you're running Harvard's endowment, you know, you want to be in on this. 20 years out, it drops back down again, but of course there are all, people got a better handle on how to do venture financing in the intervening time. And of course, I think the economy in general is getting better. But all this has caused, I mean, all this underperformance, except for some stars, has caused a big drop-off in the number of VC funds. As I said, it turns out, you know, as people learned after 2000, that it's really, really hard. It's really, really hard. So from a peak of over 2,300 active VCs in 2000, we're down to about 750 now. And I don't think that number has changed a whole lot. So what's happening is, until not too long ago, if you were a VC and you had, you know, some sort of a track record, after 2000, you could still go to your limiteds and say, I'm raising a new fund, and sorry about the last one, okay? But if you don't re-up for this next one, which we realize this is like a not the world's greatest time to, doesn't feel like the greatest time to be doing VC investments. But if you don't re-up for the one we're raising now, we're not going to let you into the one after that, and people would fall in line. It seems that that's come to an end. Again, there are some funds, but John Doerr walks into the room and says, you know, do you want to invest? And if you don't invest, I'll never let you into a fund again. You're going to, you know, and you have a university endowment, you're going to write the check. But there's a lot of pushback, and you can see why. In Q2 of 2011, there was $2.7 billion that was invested by the limiteds in 37 funds. Half of this, I checked this in three different sources because I couldn't believe it, but half of this went to one venture fund. And it's a fund which is invested in Facebook and Groupon, among other things. So I guess people figured, you know, maybe once you got lucky two, three, four, five times, you know, you must be pretty sharp people. For some reason, I don't know why this is the case. Maybe it's just something with the time of the year. Q1 of 2011. About the same number of funds received investments, but almost three times as much money went in. I'm really not sure why that was the case. But what's happening is that the funds which missed out on the most recent tech wave are just having more trouble raising money, because people are looking at those numbers I showed you in the earlier pages and saying, hey, you know, venture capital as a class is not something to just invest in anymore. I've really got to, you know, try to pick the winners, because the other ones are going to be losers. And with any of the firms which are not right at the top tier, we're starting to see the investors negotiating the deals. I mean, it used to be just 2 and 20, and you didn't discuss it. You got 2%, as a VC, you got 2% on the capital you were managing, and you got 20% of the gains. The investors are pushing back on that. And if you're not a sell who invested in Facebook and Groupon and so forth, the VCs will often talk to them. So where is all this going? Well, if you look at a little case study here of the computing industry, and this can be IT, this can be web-based, social media, anything with computers, the costs to start up are way down. And they're down for two reasons. First of all the software you used to have to spend money on has gotten real cheap. Because are you all familiar with open source? Open source is basically the software. There are various ways of getting to this, but the software is virtually free. You pay money for support, consulting, tweaking the software to make it work for you. If any of you have Android phones, that's a strong example of it's quasi-open source. The software is free. And one of the problems with Android phones compared to the iPhone is that the Android platform is a great platform, but Motorola can do one version of it, HTC can do another version, and so forth. On the other hand, they don't have to pay anything for a software license. Google just says, you know, here it is, use it, please, because that's not how we make our money. So all the software that 10 years ago you might have to spend a lot of money on, say for development platforms, if you were a company that was building enterprise software, you don't have to pay much for it anymore. The other thing is, you used to have to pay a lot of money for computers. I mean, you know, computers are cheap, and they're getting cheaper all the time. But if you're doing, let's say you're doing a social media company, you need a lot of server space, okay? And you know, you better have it when you need it, because if people try to go to your site and you everybody's really excited about your site. Any of you messed with Twitter? Remember the fail whale? You constantly get this little picture with a huge whale and a bunch of little Twitter birds trying to lift the thing out of the ocean, and it could be a big fail sign across there. It was a buzzword among the kids. They described something bad as that was a fail. That, you know, the techies would refer to major fails. So you needed a lot of server space, but the problem with it was, first of all, it cost a lot of money. As cheap as computers were, they have like a lot of server capacity. It was pretty expensive. And to ramp it up quickly was really a problem. I mean, as fast as like Dell can deliver stuff, it still takes time. You've got to plug the stuff in, you've got to get it to work and so forth. Now you just go to Amazon. Amazon has this thing called AWS, it's Amazon Web Services. And it's really interesting to log on to that site and see what's available there. I mean, if you're not a trained computer person, you'll have no idea of what they're offering in those cases. But it's cheap to begin with, and you can get as much as you want. And if you don't need as much as you thought you did, you can dial it back. And if you go viral and you're incredibly successful right out of the box, you can dial it up really quickly. So a company that might have, you know, absolutely needed venture money to start up 10 years ago can now come to my angel group and say, I need $500,000. And by the way, I'm already up and running, and I've got, you know, like 2,000 users because I just financed that on my credit card. And where's my server? I don't have any. It's all on Amazon. If I sound excited about this, it's because I am. I mean, it's just really cool. And anything that gets you out from under, you know, having to have your own IT department who's running around bringing up the servers when they crash is just a wonderful thing. And when you have, you know, like terrible weather and so forth, you don't have to worry about, you know, the power going out and all your users can't get on and they go to your competitor. So as a result, we have a lot more companies that can start up with a lot less money. And just as nature abhors a vacuum, so do investors. So in response to these funding needs, besides the angel groups, we're seeing two new things. We're seeing so-called micro VCs. They've always been around to a degree, but now there are new ones every day. The micro VC is basically a VC fund, but instead of a $500 million fund, it's a $15 million fund. And why does that work? Because they can launch companies for $250,000, do a follow-on round for another $250,000, syndicate with another one or two, and maybe get a 5x return. And they can go to investors and say, you don't have to be, Harvard's endowment, or you don't have to be, a billionaire. We need $500,000, and actually, by the way, we haven't quite closed out our funds, so, you know, for you, $250,000, just so we can get this thing done. The other thing is the rise of super angels. I can't quite understand, except maybe people like to be controversial. There are a lot of people out there who say there's no such thing as a super angel. Well, I mean, yeah, but there are. I mean, for example, there's a fellow whose name escapes me at the moment out in the West Coast, who's kind of the most super of the super angels. He announced a few months back that he was going to do, I think, 50 investments a year of $150,000 each. I mean, obviously, this guy's got, you know, lots and lots of money. So that's a super angel by anybody's model. The super angel is basically somebody who invests on a regular basis more than the typical angel. So if the average angel does a $50,000 investment per company, and the average individual angel who's operating solo maybe does a couple hundred thousand a company. The super angel does a lot of $200,000 deals and $500,000 deals and $1 million deals. And you can get companies launched with a couple of super angels or with a micro VC fund. And they're focusing on early stage investments in the $500,000 range. At the same time, individual investors are shifting to these fund structures because if you assemble into a fund, you can do bigger deals, but don't have to be gigantic deals, and you can drive a harder bargain, and you can get more protection with, you know, Series A preferred stock and so forth. So now you're a VC, and you're saying, Timothy, Christmas, you know, I'm missing out on a lot of good companies, because in the past, they would have come to me first after they burned through their credit cards and Uncle Bob. Now they're going to the angels, and they, like, never get to me. I mean, they're in, they're out, they have great exits. Maybe they're getting 4X, and to be a VC, I need some to get 10 or 20 or 100X. But I'm never going to get, you know, those big wins if I can't get the company in the first place. So some of the VCs are moving to early stage investments, and that's happening in a couple of ways. First of all, some of the big ones are coming up with some kind of creative ways for doing this. So in Cambridge, near my, we've got a little, my firm's got a little branch office in the Cambridge Innovation Center. Down the street is Dogpatch Labs, which is an incubator, which is run by Polaris Venture Partners. The Polaris is one of the big, prestigious, really high-quality venture funds. But they have some space, which is not as elegant or as nicely furnished as this room. And if you walk into it, it's tables and computers and young people working away. And you can't really tell where one company ends and the next one begins. And one of the general partners his job is to be the Polaris venture partner at Dogpatch Labs. And he's just there morning, noon, and night. And if you're an entrepreneur, you've got a problem, you just walk over and you get mentored. And if you need more money, you ask him to give you more money. So that's their creative effort to get their arms around more promising. I mean, they not everybody can get in. You've got to be a very promising company. But that's the way to get their arms around these promising companies by doing some seed stage investments and bringing more to the table than just money. You know, here's office space, here's server time, and here's a really smart person who's going to help you out and is there. You don't need an appointment. You just walk over to where he's sitting. Same time, we're seeing VCs moving to later stage deals where, you know, somebody might be doing Series B or Series C is now looking to do mezzanine rounds, and you get in, you have Goldman Sachs investing in Facebook, you know, after they've taken in I don't know how many rounds. And even hedge funds and others are seeking some early stage exposure. Again, Facebook is sort of the poster child for all this. Now, all that being said, there are still some number of companies, and not an insubstantial number, and there always will be, that need VC level funding to scale. Because not every company is going to make its entrepreneurs, its founders rich by taking in $1 million or $2 million of angel money, selling the company for $25 million and being done. Many companies need to get really big, and they can go along with angel money and bootstrapping and customer revenues and so forth. But at some point, if they're not going to get crushed, they have to scale, and that requires venture money. So, interesting trend. And one of the issues for any of you who used to read science fiction in your youth or do so now with taking trends and extrapolating them is, you know, if nothing rises to the sky, if you just extrapolate a trend, you know, eventually you get to a ridiculous result. It doesn't continue forever. But right now, if you look at the patterns, we're heading for what one commentator has referred to as the coming brick wall. And the brick wall is this. You have an increasing number of companies that are being started with angel money and can get pretty far in angel money. But some number of them are going to require venture funding to scale and to succeed. At the same time, if you flip back to that graph a few pages back that showed the number of venture capitalists big peak in 2000. It's been trickling down ever since. So you got a number of companies that are going to need venture funding and getting launched without venture funding coming up. Number of VCs who are going to be, and the amount of VC money perhaps that's going to be there to fund them when they need it going down. Mm-hmm. You know, boom, what happens? I actually take issue with the commentator who refers to this as a brick wall. I actually, my guess is that's not going to happen. My guess is that the micro VCs and the super angels of the world are going to see this coming and say, hey, okay, so just as there used to be a capital, so-called capital gap between angels who peaked out at maybe $750,000 and VCs who came in starting maybe $8 million, and that got filled by the micro VCs and the super angels and the smaller VC funds. I think people are going to come in and fill that space. And maybe we'll see a return, we'll see an increase in the number of venture funds for a while. But that is a trend right now. One other thing about the this case study is that for the limited partners, these are the people who invest in the venture funds, the people who actually provide the capital. They have some issues right now because the funds are smaller, which raises a couple of problems for the limited partners. Again, think of a university endowment or a state pension fund that operates under some fairly rigorous rules about how they allocate their investments. Well, they often operate under rules that say they can't be more than X percent of any fund. So if the funds are getting smaller, and they want to have Y percent of their assets in venture funds, they have to invest in more venture funds to meet that number. But if you start investing in more venture funds, it's harder to do a good job. And you can rapidly get to the point where you can't do a good job at all because you can't really vet all of them and you can't really watch them very well. So one very new trend which is emerging are sort of funds of funds. They're funds that invest in micro VCs. So you, because they aggregate a bunch of micro VCs, you as the endowment can go to this fund of funds and say, okay, so I'll invest in you. Okay, that's one fund. I can meet my target in terms of alternative investments. And you know, if I look down another level, I'm invested in a bunch of funds, but I don't have to try. You know, I'm not monitoring all of them. You're monitoring them for me, and you're picking them.
Is there a movement of capital to private equity that would have been in the past had been introduced?
I don't know. It's a good question. I just don't know. I didn't look at that. So the next question that everybody wants to know about, so where are valuations headed? And this is important for the investors. These are important for entrepreneurs who are hoping to get out someday. It's important to everybody. Again, there certainly has been some frothiness. You know, is Facebook a bubble investment? Was LinkedIn a bubble investment when it went out and had, I think they actually briefly were trading at double their initial offering price. Certainly with the events of the last few weeks, it's probable that valuations are heading back to something a little more normal. And even before the stock market started having its little flip out, because of the number of these so-called lean startups that don't require a lot of money to get going, increasing and having to look to a decreasing number of VCs to be able to scale, that also was creating a downward or expected to create a downward pressure on valuations, which is good for those of us on the investor side of the house. The third set of trends I wanted to talk about were deal trends. How are the deals trending? So we looked at first of all, Series A deals, this is the first preferred stock round, as most of you know, in the New England area, and did a quick comparison with some recent quarters and also with Silicon Valley. And I think actually the difference between New England and Silicon Valley is the most interesting. So we looked at four provisions that are common in venture capital or angel deals. First one is cumulative dividends. In other words, the dividends, there's a dividend rate and it builds up over time, and when you eventually cash in, you get all of that. Something like 70% of the New England Series A deals had cumulative dividends provisions. In Q4 of 2010, I don't think it's on your copies because I just got this data. In Q1 of this year, a little more than half that number, 42%, had cumulative dividends. That is as big as the swing is from 70 to 42%. That still feels a little bit random. It doesn't take much to throw that off. What's really interesting is only 8% of the deals in Silicon Valley had cumulative dividends. And you know, people are always comparing us with the West Coast, and some of the comparisons are unfair, like, oh, there's so many more angels out there. Well, yeah, well, there are a hell of a lot more people. There are more companies. Yeah, well, there's a hell of a lot more people. I mean, population of California is, what, 30, 40 million? I mean, it's a good-sized country. On the other hand, some of this stuff, in terms of investment styles, is really different. And a lot of venture funds, you know, have offices on both coasts. So, you know, there can't be a business reason why 8% of Silicon Valley deals had cumulative dividends and 42% of New England ones did. It really does seem that there is, even though we're all one country, there is a cultural difference. And New England just seems to engender a little bit more of a lender mentality. Participating preferred, which means that as a preferred stockholder, you can have your cake and eat it too. Company cashes in, you can say, okay, so I invested $8 million, I get it all back, then I convert my preferred stock to common stock, and what's left over after I took that $8 million gets split up among just not the employees who had common stock, but also I get to participate in that also. That goes up and down with economic terms. Like right after 2000, you saw participating preferred. You saw like 3X participation preferred. You know, I get my money back three times and then I participate. I mean, some of the stuff was just brutal. There, we're not that different from Silicon Valley. We are very different, again, on redemption clauses. Redemption clauses, for those of you who may not be involved in this a lot, is basically the investor's protection against it becoming a lifestyle company. It's poking along, but it's never getting to an exit, and you've been in for 5 years, so you have the right to go in and say, give me my money back, you know, with or without interest or whatever, but I want to be redeemed out. So 75, 85% of New England Series A terms deals have had that, 20% in the most recent quarter in Silicon Valley. I have no explanation for that other than cultural differences. Another interesting trend, and this goes along with, well, I was talking earlier about how much cheaper it's getting to start a company. So you may have heard the term lean startup. I mean, this is actually like a movement. There's a guy named Eric Ries who's written the Bible of lean startups. There are meetings you can go to around Boston of tech groups that are at the lean startup meetup that meets once a month over at the Microsoft Center in Cambridge. And it's all about, you know, start fast, start cheaply, fail fast if you need to, but you don't need a lot of money to get it out there. And how can you do it really cheaply? Well, this is even, regrettably, but I actually think it's a good idea, hit the legal profession, and under pressure, largely, I think, from the investors who said, look, you know, I'm a venture capitalist. I always go in and I tell the lawyers on both sides, I'll pay X dollars to have this deal closed and no more. Just, you know, just do it or you'll never see another deal from me again. That's fine. But that wasn't enough, because the other thing the VCs were saying, and I think appropriately so, is, you know, damn it, you know, not only am I paying too much for this stuff, but I'm paying you guys to argue about stuff that just doesn't matter. I mean, yes, I asked for registration rights, you know, the right to force the company to go public, basically. But we all know that we never actually use those clauses. okay? I mean, I may lean on the company to go public, but I don't do it by actually using those clauses. And, but you put these clauses, which are pretty complicated, in front of the lawyers, and, you know, they have to work on it. They can't just say, well, you know, never mind, it'll all be fine. And they certainly can't say that to their entrepreneur company. So there's a, it's about 2 or 3 year old initiative. There's no central person driving it, but various VCs in conjunction with their favorite lawyers have been driving it to do lean deal documents. And the idea is you take, 5 minutes, okay, you, good, timing's perfect. You take the standard deal documents and you pare away the fat. So you make them simpler, you make them more entrepreneur friendly. And the other thought was we're gonna standardize them. That is a major fail. And this has happened every time the legal profession has tried to standardize the things. We tried, a very bright guy named Andrew Tote, about 25 years ago, tried to do this with software licenses. Brilliant job. I mean, I still have the documents from the American Bar Association committee that he chaired. I mean, terrific reference tool, never used. Opinion letters, tried to standardize that. That didn't work. This has sort of worked in that it's produced useful model documents and term sheets. But the last time I looked, there are at least 4 and maybe 5 competing standard lean deal documents, 2 of which can't come from the same law firm. So and I know a couple of people in town, a couple of investors who are key players in this drive to do lean deal documents. And I talked to one of them recently, and I said, so how many of your deals are use these documents? And he said, well, actually not many. Not quite sure why. But nevertheless, I mean, it is an improvement. I've used these documents in some deals of my own. And we certainly got to the issues, the key issues, a lot faster. We didn't waste a lot of time on this stuff. So I'll close. The last page here is some suggested further reading. There's a really interesting article that you'll find at the Founders Fund, which is one of the new wave VCs, foundersfund.com. The introduction to it is we wanted flying cars and we got 140 characters. And what, you know, why aren't we doing like more interesting companies? And why we should be swinging for the fences? You know, why aren't we doing like, you know, the equivalent of airplanes and railroads instead of like another variation on Groupon? Cambridge Associates, the consulting firm, has got a bunch of private equity, which will answer your questions, and venture capital indices. And if you're a data hound, you can get lost there. I would also commend to you something I just saw a couple of days ago. There's a friend of mine named Brad Harkavy, who's a angel investor, entrepreneur, C-level executive for hire for startup companies. Did a post on the Venture Fizz, F-I-Z-Z, .com blog about what's the commotion in the markets is going to mean about angel investing. And he's got some interesting thoughts on this, which make a lot of sense. I thought his best line was he said 25K is the new 50. In other words, he expects angel investing to keep going. It's just people aren't going to feel as rich. Okay, well, thank you. Any questions, comments?
For Richard or for each other about this topic?
I just had one quick question. This private placement marketplace, a lot of people are starting to say it could be dangerous for kind of, you know, investors who aren't very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as potentially, you know, being a risk to some of the momentum? Because it does take longer for companies to reach the public stage these days.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think not. Okay, this is really a guess. And the reason I think not is that there's such an increasing tendency for angels to band together in groups that the people who, say 10 years ago, might have said, I made my money in a low-tech business. I'm a good judge of people. I can read the balance sheet. I have no idea what the technology is these guys are talking about, but I like them. So, you know, I'll take a flyer on it. You know, we'll now be in the group where there are people who understand the technology, they're doing more thorough due diligence. So I think it's, you know, as risky as ever. I'm not sure it's going to scare those people away. In fact, one of the thoughts behind the Sidecar Angel Group is that we're going to be able to tell people like this, look, if you join this group, you don't have to worry about even being asked to do the due diligence. Conversely, the only companies you're ever going to have presented to you are companies that some other group or micro VC in town has done the due diligence on, has negotiated the deal. You know, they're ready to invest. They just need money to round out the round. But, yeah, it's a good question.
Is Sidecar a fund or is it going to be individuals?
It's going to be individuals making their decisions. It's a little complicated. We are going to require, we are requiring that members commit to put in $10,000 a year for 3 years, although if they decide they want to change their mind, they can back out of it, so that there will be a central pot of money which can be deployed by consensus or majority vote. But that's more of a credibility builder, so that we go out initially, we can say to the people we want to have syndicate with us, look, we have this pot of money ready to deploy, but the expectation is most of the money will come from individuals saying, okay, so I've got my piece of the central fund that's been invested, but that's like maybe $2,000, you know, per investment. I really like this company. I'm going to put in 25.
When you look at the data on the cumulative dividends, part of that, that what stage, do you see more cumulative dividends on the D rounds versus the A? Was that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have any data on that. The only data I could find was cumulative.
Because it seemed to me when I looked at Q2 data, mm-hmm. There were very large investments mm-hmm. in very well-established companies that people chose, said, hey, we want to keep this going. Versus mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. If you guys want to stay and continue this conversation, you're welcome to do so, and if you need to leave, you're welcome to do so. I look forward to seeing you next month. Our program, George Neville, who is partner of Ernst and Young, is going to be talking about the magic trio of the audit committee, the CPA firm, and the board, and the CFO, and managing that relationship. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And probably within 4 days, I'll be sending out a note to all of you with Richard's talk on MP3.
Great.
So you can download it and pass it to others.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I think the Dunkin' Brands. They may have.
At the time, I